This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Callan, is one of the people with AIDS who has survived the longest. He was diagnosed in 1982. According to the best estimate, he says, only 25 of the over 1,000 Americans diagnosed that year are still alive. His new book, Surviving AIDS, tells his story along with the stories of 13 other long-term survivors. The summer he found out he was sick, he decided to do something he'd wanted to do for a long time, organize a band. Callan is a singer who now performs with the a cappella group The Flirtations. He's also an AIDS activist. He co-founded the People with AIDS Coalition, perhaps the first group in the AIDS self-empowerment movement. And he co-founded the Community Research Initiative, which conducts scientific research on promising AIDS therapies in a community-based setting which is intended to yield faster results than the medical establishment has. Michael Callan told me he was diagnosed before the disease was even called AIDS, when it was known as gay-related immune deficiency, or GRID.
Well, actually, I had the symptoms of what everyone came to know was AIDS for at least a year before I got my official diagnosis, which was in the summer of 1982. I knew I was sick for some time, and when I first heard about or read reports of this new mysterious sexually transmitted disease, there was never any question in my mind that I was going to get it. I matched the profile of the early cases of AIDS. I had a long, distinguished track record of sexually transmitted diseases, many sexual partners, and so it was not a surprise to me when the doctor came in the summer of 82 and said, well, it's GRID, which then became AIDS.
What did he tell you in terms of the prognosis?
Well, actually it was a she, and she didn't really talk about, you know, prognosis. Actually, I'm very lucky. None of my doctors have ever, like, looked me in the eye and said, you have 6 months to live. The doctor who diagnosed my first opportunistic infection said it was a disease. I had cryptosporidium, which is an intestinal parasite infection, and she said, we didn't think that humans could get this. It was a disease of cattle.
That's encouraging, isn't it?
Yeah.
Makes you feel good.
Took me a while to take that in, and she said, all she said was, you'll either handle it or you won't. And that was as close as she came to saying, you know, you might be dead in a week or 6 months. AIDS in the early days was often very rapidly fatal. There's some speculation now that it might even have been a different disease or more virulent in the early days. Certainly people got very sick, multiple opportunistic complications, and tended to die very quickly. And I was vaguely aware of that. There wasn't really a network of people with AIDS who got together and talked. So you sort of picked it up through the grapevine, that this was a really devastating disease that could carry you off very quickly. But I was very lucky. When I was diagnosed in late 82, I joined the first support group for people with AIDS ever formed in New York City. And as fate would have it, I met one of the longest surviving people with AIDS in medical literature. At the time I met him in 82, he had been retrospectively diagnosed with Kaposi sarcoma and therefore AIDS back to 1978. So he had already had AIDS for 4 years. He was witty, vivacious, had a business, traveled the world. Just knowing that someone else had been there seemed to make it easier to enter the long-term survivor sweepstakes.
How has your health been since 1982 when you were diagnosed?
Well, it's one of the many paradoxes of AIDS that I've been healthier since getting AIDS than I was in the years before I got AIDS. I mean, by that I mean relatively speaking. I have virtually no immune system and have not had any... I have never had above 200 T4 cells since I was first tested in 1981. But paradoxically, I've had fewer colds, fewer flus, no sexually transmitted disease. All the rashes and drips and rashes and, fevers and all that stuff that were so much just you took it in stride when you were part of the sexual revolution of the 70s and early 80s. All that evaporated because I started practicing safer sex. And I'm hospitalized at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. My main problem, I now have Kaposi's sarcoma. I've managed to peaceably coexist with cryptosporidium. My main problem is bacterial pneumonia, which I get right on cue every year. But it's fortunately not pneumocystis pneumonia, which is the very serious pneumonia that affects people with AIDS and that is responsible for most AIDS deaths. So I'm lucky. I'm functional. I lead what I consider a super normal life. I'm more productive than I've ever been at any point in my life, and I'm happier than I've ever been at any point in my life. Of course, I wish I didn't have AIDS, and I wish I could put this all behind me, but this is the hand that life has dealt me, and I intend to play it however long I have on this earth.
Michael Callan is my guest, and he has AIDS, and he's one of the people who survived the longest with AIDS. He's written a new book called Surviving AIDS. He's also an AIDS activist. We'll be talking about some of his work as an activist in a couple of minutes. Probably a lot of people want to know, what drugs have you been taking that have helped you survive this long? And the truth is that the most frequently used AIDS drug, you haven't taken at all. You've never taken AZT.
I have never taken a single AZT pill. And one of the things that surprised me, although pleasantly this time, was that very, very few of the long-term survivors I interviewed have ever touched AZT. I have in my book a whole chapter devoted to the case against AZT. I happen to believe that AZT is chemical genocide. It's fraud from start to finish. I say in the book, and I firmly believe, that a person who is immunologically impaired or who has AIDS has to decide whether they want to try to be a survivor of AIDS or try to be a survivor of AZT, because I don't believe that you can do both. AZT was a drug that was invented in the 60s as a potential therapy for cancer, and it was abandoned as unfit for human use because it interrupts DNA synthesis wherever it finds it. In other words, it does not differentiate between infected or malnormal, or it just kills cells wherever it finds them. The one thing that everybody agrees about AZT is that it suppresses the bone marrow. The bone marrow is the only source that a person with AIDS has for generating the cells that she or he needs to survive. How taking a drug that kills the very source of the cells you need can, as a long-term strategy, benefit anyone is beyond me. And there is now a growing awareness that AZT isn't turning out to be everything that we've been sold. It's in addition to being the most expensive drug in the history of the pharmaceutical industry, and to have been approved by the FDA on the basis of fraudulent research, which has been amply documented before. And there's a new book that actually goes behind the scenes and talks about the scandalous pharmaceutical intrigue that led to the approval of AZT. The fact is, almost none of the long-term survivors took AZT. There is ample evidence which argues against it, and I would encourage anyone in your listening audience who is making that painful, difficult choice about whether to take AZT or not to do their homework, seek out all sorts of different opinions, talk to people who've taken it who like it, talk to people who've taken it who had to go off of it, talk to people who decided never to go on it, and then go off in the woods by yourself and sort it all out and make your own decision. But whatever you do, don't take AZT just because your doctor tells you to.
I should mention here that there are AIDS activist groups who endorse the use of AZT, that your opinion is perhaps in a minority.
Yes, absolutely. A growing minority, I'm pleased to say, mm-hmm. but definitely a minority.
Have you ever had second thoughts? Did you ever feel like, you know, maybe I really ought to be taking it? It's a very hard decision. To decide whether to take a drug or not. Of course, your doctor didn't recommend it, so it wasn't as hard as it would be for someone whose doctor did recommend it.
Well, I have to say that I've taken a number of controversial political positions in my career as an AIDS activist. None has subjected me to the brutality from the government and within my own community as my position about AZT. I am as convinced as I am of anything in this world that AZT is killing people. And it's not something that I like to say. It's not easy to say, because often when I address a group of people with AIDS, the overwhelming majority of people are on it. And I've done my homework, and the way I present the case against AZT in the book and when I speak publicly, there is ample evidence, theoretical and published evidence in the medical literature, against the use of AZT that concludes that it does not extend life, that it causes cancer. And most people making that momentous decision are not aware that this literature exists. They're led to believe that only a few crazy people like me oppose it for reasons that are not entirely rational. And I say it in the book, and I would say it to your listeners, the decision of whether or not to take AZT is probably the most momentous decision that a person with AIDS makes, and it is not a decision to be made lightly. And if you're going to do your homework about any particular aspect of AIDS, that's where I would recommend people start.
You're a co-founder of the Community Research Initiative, which is, let me ask you to describe what the function of this group is.
Well, the Community Research Initiative is now an entire movement. There are over 45 CRIs around the country. When we founded it in 1987, it was a measure of our intense frustration with the failure of the federal AIDS treatment research effort to find anything of value for people with AIDS. I'm fond of saying that the AIDS treatment research bureaucracy will turn out to be the HUD of the 90s. Billions have been spent, nothing has been produced, and there's been no accountability. Those of us living with AIDS were so frustrated that we came up with an idea radical in its simplicity. Here in America, drug treatment research has been entirely controlled by academic medical centers and by the pharmaceutical industry. But we people with AIDS felt that our physicians, our community physicians who were actually keeping us alive on a day-to-day basis, who had the hands-on experience and who had our interests at heart, should group together with people with AIDS themselves and other research experts to design our own clinical trials. And that's exactly what we did. And strangely enough, what we discovered was that the pharmaceutical industry was itself quite frustrated with how cumbersome and inefficient the federal AIDS treatment bureaucracy was. And though in the first 2 years they kept their distance but kept meeting with us and were very interested and occasionally would give us money, after the community research groups in San Francisco and New York actually completed a clinical trial of aerosol pentamidine for the prevention of the number one killer of people with AIDS, pneumocystis pneumonia. After that research led to FDA approval of aerosol pentamidine, we were besieged by pharmaceutical companies eager to conduct their trials in our community-based setting. The advantage or the major difference between the community-based research movement and the way drugs are tested here in America in other diseases is that we believed that if people with AIDS have a say in designing the protocols, in saying what risks they're willing to take and what risks they're not willing to take, that we will have better enrollment and better compliance with the protocols, which will mean that the value, the scientific value of data generated by community-based research, we believe is of a higher quality than government AIDS research, which is often viewed by people with AIDS as punitive.
Well, yeah, you say that the federally designed clinical trials are often unethical and poorly designed, and that community-based research is trying to design trials and research groups that are more sensitive to people with AIDS. Can you compare?
Yeah, well, one quick example that will illustrate the point. A number of the early federal trials forbid people from taking any medication to prevent pneumocystis pneumonia, which was the number one killer of people with AIDS, even though it had become the unofficial community standard for anyone with 200 or fewer T cells to be put on some form of medication to prevent pneumonia. And the reason that the government forbid the use of preventive therapies was because they wanted to use death as a measure of the effectiveness of a drug. If people in the trial died, then you would know, if people getting the drug didn't die and people not getting the drug died, then you would attribute the benefit to the drug. We felt that was really unethical, and that people who died, for example, of pneumocystis in the AZT trial or in some of the early trials, didn't have to die. And that is not a risk that the community-based research movement would ever ask subjects to take. It's unnecessary. There are other equally scientifically valid ways of designing trials that will give you, credible scientific information. And, I mean, unfortunately, AIDS treatment research is littered with atrocities that were unnecessary and ultimately counterproductive, because what happened is that people entering government trials cheated, and the value of the data is pretty useless.
Do you think that the National Institute of Health is using more of an academic model of, focusing on accuracy but taking the kind of slow route to that accuracy, as opposed to taking the route that would get the information and the drugs out the soonest to the people who have AIDS?
Well, I have to state it this strongly. I think that we've been given the third string of scientists, not the first string and not the second string. I would flush the entire lot of them, admit defeat, start anew. New personnel, try to find ways to attract the top scientists, not just in the country, but in the world. Send the message loud and clear that we really want to solve the AIDS problem and that we're willing to put the resources behind it necessary to do that. I mean, we've spent 8 years of federally financed AIDS research, and we are nowhere.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you think that the third string scientists are working on AIDS. It seems like it's such a huge problem that I would think that the best scientists would be eager to work on AIDS-related research.
Well, there are two problems. One is that in the early days, the best scientists weren't attracted to it because of the stigma associated with the disease. The groups that got AIDS, I mean, you'd have to deal with homosexuals and drug users and people of color, and it just wasn't, believe it or not, it just in the early years of the epidemic, it was not a sexy career choice. And then the problem now, even though there's a lot of money, government money flowing, what happened is that there's we call it the AIDS mafia. There's a group of incompetent, arrogant people that totally control AIDS research. They review each other's papers, and it's an old boy network that is just impenetrable. So a young scientist or a really qualified scientist who would like to come with fresh ideas about AIDS, how to approach treatment that isn't entirely antiretroviral, would never be admitted into this fraternity of AIDS researchers that have so bungled AIDS research so far, spent billions, and are complicit in the deaths of tens of thousands of Americans.
What kinds of results are coming out of community research now?
Well, primarily community research has announced that it will concentrate on opportunistic infections, prevention, treatment, and control. Many of them are also looking for investigating immune modulators, things that might improve immune function, and some are also testing antiretrovirals. But generally, the government is almost exclusively testing antiretroviral therapies, and the community research movement is investigating the other two areas which have not been much investigated by the government, which is opportunistic infection research and immune modulation.
So is community research testing drugs that haven't been approved yet by the FDA? And if so, how do you get access to them?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the pharmaceutical companies have a whole storehouse full of drugs that they would love to test. And FDA approval isn't required in most instances to... Well, it's a whole complicated thing. It has to pass certain safety requirements and animal tests. But there are many, many drugs that have passed that, which for whatever reason the government isn't interested in testing in the context of AIDS, that the community research movement is quite interested in testing.
Would you be willing to be in one of those studies yourself, to be a guinea pig for an untested drug?
You mean a community-based research protocol?
Yeah,
I have been. I am, yes. I actually believe that many people with AIDS are willing to take greater risks than some people might imagine for the greater good of the greater number of people, provided that there's reason to believe that there will be a payoff for that risk, if not for themselves, for others, that the data generated by the trial will be scientifically credible and that the FDA will be able to rely on it. But what has happened in the case of government research is that people take risks, they suffer, the data is presented, and the FDA rejects it because it's so sloppy.
Do you like to research a drug before participating in a study of it?
Absolutely.
So that you know what it is you're ingesting.
I would never, ever, ever take a drug unless I knew everything that is currently known about the drug. Theoretical use in humans, animal experiments. There's a process called informed consent, and it's the community-based research movement takes that process very seriously and ensures that people considering entering one of its trials know everything there is to know in simple, understandable language about what they're being asked to take or do.
Do you participate in double-blind studies? Do you know if you're getting the drug or a placebo when you participate in community research?
Generally speaking, the community research movement has stated that it wishes to avoid placebo double-blind trials wherever possible. There are instances in which that is the best, safest, cleanest way to get an answer. If it's a drug that just has not been used in any other disease or in humans, a quick and dirty placebo double-blind trial might be the fastest way. But generally speaking, the overwhelming majority of community-based clinical trial designs do not include a placebo.
Have you decided recently to resign from some of your activist groups in order to take care of your own health?
Yes, I in fact have just moved from New York to Los Angeles from New York, and I have resigned from each of the organizations that I talk about in my book. I've done two tours of duty. It's time for the next generation, and it's time for me to start taking my own advice. And my life, AIDS activism is quite brutal. People, it's a life and death struggle, and people hold their opinions passionately. And there are many enemies and lots of suffering. And I'm a musician, and I'd like to have a life beyond AIDS. And I feel that I've done my bit. I've spoken and written. And anybody who is interested in what Michael Callan thinks about any aspect of AIDS with just the slightest effort can find it in a library or by calling the People with AIDS Coalition. And it isn't necessary for me anymore to be traveling 180,000 air miles from one end of the earth to the other, preaching the same gospel.
Michael Callan, thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you good health.
Thank you.
My guest has been singer-songwriter and AIDS activist Michael Callan. His new book is called Surviving AIDS.